You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we talk to the author of Your Favorite Band Is Killing Me about musical rivalries and what they tell us about ourselves and our culture.
First, there's been a tone shift in American liberalism in recent years. According to our next guest, it's a tone that some might find in everything from political conversations to social media to popular satirical news programs like The Daily Show. Here's a taste of The Daily Show with its most recent host, Trevor Noah, mocking Republicans and poking fun at their response to President Obama's Supreme Court nomination.
Listen, Republicans, I understand what you're going through. You lost Justice Scalia, a legendary conservative justice, and you don't want him replaced by anyone that Obama likes. But here's the big question. How do you think this is going to play out? Because what? You filibuster this guy until Obama is gone? Then what happens? Because what if Hillary Clinton becomes president and she picks Garland or someone even more liberal? Or, God forbid, Donald Trump becomes president. And who knows what he'd do? Like, he could do anything. He could pick Judge Judy. He could, just because he's heard of her. You don't know what he'd do.
Our next guest is Emmett Renson. He's an essayist and deputy first-person editor for Vox.com. And he wrote the recent essay, The Smug Style in American Liberalism. Emmett, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you write that pretty much the smug style that you're talking about can be reduced to a single sentence. Why are they voting against their own self-interest? What bugs you about the way that that particular sentence has been used by the left?
What bugs me about it mostly is that it imagines that there are two parties, one of whom is acting entirely in the interests of poor people in the United States, and the other isn't. In reality, both parties are offering fairly bad deals, the least amongst us. And instead of addressing this fact, we have liberal Democrats who would rather believe that poor people and dispossessed people don't support them are merely stupid.
We're talking right now with Emmett Renson. We're going to try to get a little bit of a better connection for Emmett as we talk about his recent essay about the smug style in American liberalism. And this is one that was published in Vox.com. Emmett making the case that liberals are alienating people when they make the case that certain people are uninformed, that they're voting against their self-interest, that they're maybe ignorant and they don't know the facts. And that's the case he makes in this piece. And Emmett, are you back with us?
I believe I am.
Great. We sound a little bit clearer now. So we're going to go ahead and talk a little bit about what you mean by smugness. What does smugness mean in this context?
Well, in the essay, just to be clear, I mean, I define something called the smug style, which, I put it as a proper noun. So it's not exactly the same as, you know, just being smug, the general idea. You know, a lot of people are smug, conservative smug people. There are liberal smug people. There are, you know, leftists who are smug. That's not really the point. The smug style, what I mean by that, it's a couple of things that I think a big part of liberal culture believes right now. And the first thing is that political conflict isn't really a moral conflict. What it is a conflict about information asymmetries, that some people just know good, important facts and act accordingly, and some people don't. It also believes that liberals have a monopoly on these good facts, this correct information, and that liberalism is not ideological. It's just the rational response to those good facts. And because I think a lot of people think this, they don't see the problem with conservatives as being necessarily a moral problem. You know, when they say why are they voting against their own self-interest, they're not saying they're morally incorrect. They're saying they just don't have the good information because any rational person who wasn't dumb who had this good information would agree with us.
Why are you using the word moral as the opposite here?
You know, because it's something that you see resisted a lot, especially in sort of the moderate liberalism. Is a sort of allergy to moral argument, which ends up confusing a lot of political conversations because you end up talking about facts in a vacuum and charts and studies in a vacuum without really being able to identify what their moral purpose is. You know, there are a lot of pieces that do this. I have my favorite examples of them, but It's really hard to develop a coherent political program if you don't have moral commitments. It's hard to even know what to do with facts and data. You know, I'm obviously not against, you know, empiricism or the use of data and information in order to drive policy. But of course, you have to know what that's for. You have to know what facts are important, what those facts are telling you about the world, and what you want the world to be. So you can decide whether the facts you're getting are good or bad, or if they're showing you a problem or showing you a solution.
And you're pointing out in your piece, you say that it hasn't always been this way. You said that American liberalism has changed over the last century because of demographic changes and other factors. What happened? What changed?
Well, a lot of things changed. I think the big thing that most people look to, right, is something that basically happened after the end of Franklin Roosevelt's presidency through about the end of Ronald Reagan's presidency, where you had large segments of the working class leave the Democratic Party or just drop out of politics in general. And that happened for a lot of reasons. I mean, you know, a lot of it was racially motivated. There were a lot of white working class people who were persuaded by Nixon's Southern strategy and then by Reagan's sort of continuation of that strategy that the Democratic Party was embracing, you know, not just like the civil rights movement, but you know, feminism, the sexual revolution, anti-war protesters. So there was this sort of enormous crack up in the old Democratic coalition that had its own problems. But the smug style, and I say this in the essay, is really a reaction to that fact. Right, the huge demographic shifts that happened in the party coalitions in the United States were determined by an enormous number of factors. But the consequence of it in the long run was that the Democratic Party abandoned or just stopped prioritizing a lot of programs that benefit workers and poor people.
And so then how do you see the Democratic Party when in the context of the smug style that you're writing about, what was the response there? What happened with the smug style that developed in the vacuum of some of these voters that went away?
Well, I think, and I say in the piece, I think that the center of gravity of the Democratic Party, sort of intellectual and policy center, changed. You know, it used to be that And there were always, you know, sort of elites and academics and coastal people, but it used to be that the labor movement, for example, was a huge, huge driver of Democratic Party politics. You know, it used to be that, like, not in its pure form, but sort of the intellectual descendants of Marxism were part of how Democratic policy was made. What happened as a result of this demographic shift is sort of the center of gravity in liberal intellectual life, not just geographically moved to the coast, but also moved in class. It became a party dominated by people who are more affluent and, more importantly, by people who are professionals as opposed to workers.
We're talking right now with Emmett Renson, essayist and deputy first-person editor at Vox.com. He says that there's a certain strain of liberalism that has developed a smug style, and we're talking about that right now. And Emmett, looking at the candidacy of Donald Trump, how does that smug style you write about play into maybe his success, or how do you see it maybe playing out down the road?
Well, look, people will point out, and I think they're correct to point out, that, you know, the central plank of Donald Trump's platform is bigotry. Donald Trump is a racist, he is a sexist, he is an Islamophobe. And you see a lot of angry people, and there's a whole live dispute right now over sort of the economics of his supporters, but you obviously see a lot of people responding to that. And I think part of the problem with the smug style, right, is that the liberal response to that fact tends to be to say, well, these people believe horrible things. They're voting for this horrible person who is exploiting those things, but not saying, how did we get to a point where these people were so susceptible to this kind of rhetoric? You have to be very angry, and you have to want deeply to find somebody to blame for that in order for someone like Donald Trump to be successful. And for the same reason that, you know, say George Wallace was appealing. You know, you have in the aftermath of this piece, I've had liberals point out to me, that, you know, a lot of these voters, especially Trump voters, obviously are motivated by racism and by sexism. You know, I don't know about the percentages, but it's a significant number. And that's true, but that is more or less saying, yes, there is a conservative party in this country that is willing to exploit bigotry to get elected. And I don't think that the proper response to that is to say, well, okay, let them have them. We don't need those people anyway. There's a reason that that's sort of the best thing on offer as far as a lot of these people can tell. And it's, you know, desperation and disillusionment. And, you know, if someone comes around and tells you what you want to hear and tells you it's not your fault and tells you that, you know, these foreigners and women and liberals are to blame, then some people are going to go for that. Even if it's a fraud, if you get to a point of desperation, that is going to seem very appealing, and all it has historically.
In our last minute here, I want to ask you briefly about a critique of your argument from Slate, a columnist there, Jamelle Bouie, saying that what really drove the working class whites away from the Democratic Party was its alliance with people of color. And I wonder what you think about that. Do you think that appeals to people of color and maybe prejudice are more to blame?
Well, as I said 5 seconds ago and 5 minutes ago, a huge part of the coalition crackup was racially motivated. One of the biggest mistakes that the labor movement ever made in the United States was in 1968, when rather than embrace the civil rights platforms that the Democratic Party was pushing for, they defected to Richard Nixon. And part of the consequence of that was that organized labor was largely destroyed in this country because it turned out the Republicans they defected to weren't really interested in sticking up for them either. I read that Slate piece. It's interesting. I don't, at least on that count of sort of the two arguments being made in that piece, I don't think the argument that racism had a lot to do with why these people left the Democratic Party is wrong, but it's also something that I addressed in my essay and not something that really bears on the argument of right now.
Emmett, thanks a lot for joining us. We're out of time. That was Emmett Renson. He's an essayist and deputy first person editor for Vox.com.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stick around, more to come.